It was 100 years ago, March 4th, 1910, that Busty Coggin, a legendary Anishinaabe leader from northern Minnesota, died tragically in a hotel in Washington, D.C. There's been a little bit of mystery surrounding his death, but it is known that he died from a gas poisoning, from a gas lamp that was in his hotel room. And the legend of Busty Coggin is far, deep and wide, I guess we should say, and been the subject of books and a lot of conversation in northern Minnesota, especially northern Itasca County. And no one's better qualified to bring us up to date on that story of this legendary Native American than Bill Marshall. Bill has lived in Itasca County for over 60 years, was the land commissioner, and you lived up in Busty Country for a while, didn't you, Bill?
Oh, yeah. We came up there in 1949 as a young forester for the state, and was there for 6 years, and I got to know a lot of people that had known Busty Coggin. And very interesting, found out just where he lived and everything.
Where did he live?
Well, he lived out east of Effie, about 7 miles, right on the Big Fork River. And his little campsite on the Big Fork River had a trail going up to Busty's Lake, which is just a quarter of a mile away. And it was a nice little portage trail. And he had a nice little home there.
Wonderful article in the recent edition of the Western Itasca Review with a few pictures of Busty, one in a canoe and one with some other folks in the woods. And the Busty was definitely a leader. He represented, as best he could, the Anishinaabe of northeastern Minnesota in some of the treaties, didn't he?
Yeah, he was a Bois Fort Indian. He'd come down from Canada, and he was born about 1830 up there on the English River. But he moved down in and was a chief in the Bois Fort Band, and the Deer Lake area there was part of his domain.
Mm-hmm. We think of the Bois Fort Reservation now as just around Net Lake, but what those ceded territories were huge, where the Anishinaabe hunted, fished, lived, trapped, and carried out their whole. Different cultures, different clans all over northern Minnesota. They had a different idea about boundaries and surveying and whose territory was what, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. You know, they had the idea that land belonged to everyone, kind of, and so they didn't have boundaries as such. But they had very few people also to fill up this great area. So Busty was pretty much by himself over in this Big Fork, Effie area.
Yeah, that's so interesting. He's a big man, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. He's a big, powerful fellow, over 6 feet tall. And you see that picture of him in a canoe. He looks like he's lucky he doesn't tip over.
Well, the circumstances of his death, how would you describe them?
Well, he was called to Washington to represent their interests on some lands that had been ceded to the government. They were trying to get some repayment for them. And he was used to these kerosene lamps. When you had an old kerosene lamp at night, when you're done, you blew the thing out. Well, he got to Washington and had this coal gas lamp, which is an entirely different type of fuel. And he thought, well, you just blow the thing out. Well, he blew it out and they asphyxiated everybody in the room. There were barely three people in there.
Was there any conspiracy theories at the time floating around that Busty was murdered?
Well, I don't think so. There may have been. There are all kinds of theories floating around. There's all kinds of theories about all of the money that he has buried up there. But if he has, nobody's ever said much about it.
Yeah. Now, Busty Township, it was said that Busty owned a lot of land up in Effie area. How would you describe his land holdings and how they came and went?
Well, by the time we were up there in the late 40s, his land was one allotment on the river in Busty's Lake. He had a son that had an allotment, and his wife had an allotment. They were all 40 to 50 acres large. Apparently, at one time, there had been a lot more, but he'd sold it to the government. Mm-hmm. And that's where they also thought he had gotten a lot of money for what he sold, a lot of timber on the lands in Busty Town.
So that was the rumor of Busty's gold, huh?
His hidden gold. That's right. And in fact, this old Indian fellow at when I knew him back in the 1970s, he was out at Leisure Hills, and one a friend of ours from Inger, an Indian woman that could speak Chippewa very well, took me out there to talk to him. His name was Sam Goggle. He couldn't speak any English, to my knowledge, but she asked him about this gold, because he was one of the people that was supposed to go to Washington with Busty. And he was just a 16-year-old kid, but he had a premonition that it would be bad news if he went, so he stayed home. And apparently he was pretty glad he had. But he said that Busty had this money buried in a little copper container, and it was back in the woods from this little home he had on the Big Fork River, and that he could be up to, he wouldn't tell his wife where it was, but he had this little burial spot for his container, and he'd go up there frequently, not frequently, but every once in a while to get some money. People would buy potatoes from him, which he's growing on the along the river there, and she could holler to him, and he could answer her, so... But he said he did have quite a bit of money in this copper container. And so that's given rise to the idea that there might still be some buried up there somewhere. Mm-hmm. She never could find it, apparently. After he died, they were all looking for it, and a lot of holes dug here and there. But, you know, you could do a lot of digging in a huge tract of land and not get very far.
Yeah. Busty won the affection of a lot of white people up in the region for what's been described as his heroic efforts during a smallpox infection. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, those things get pretty fuzzy. They apparently did have there was a big logging camp up on the Caldwell Brook, which flows into the Big Fork River. That's up in Couchiching County, back between Effie and... North home, there's a road that goes north here in Wildwood Township, and that goes back to this old Caldwell Brook camp. And that supposedly was where the incident took place, where Busty came into the camp, saw that there was no smoke coming out of the chimneys, wondered what's up. Everybody had smallpox. The people that didn't have it took off because they didn't. And the poor guys who were sick were lying around there in their bunks. So he kind of helped take care of the things, and... The owner of the camp, everything was over, Busty'd kind of nursed some of these people back to health, and they were very grateful for that. But the owner decided he's going to burn up the whole place because it was so full of smallpox germs. So they had this huge fire and put all the bodies and everything in one place. And I was up to this camp a few times, and logging camp. It's very interesting, right along the creek there. You can see they dug out foundations where the old buildings had been, and there's a big pile of kind of mixed ash and cinders and everything else there, so that could very well be that had happened. Hmm. But things get swallowed in history, and yeah, hard to know just what it was all about.
What exactly happened, yeah. Do we know, did Busty leave much in the way of oral stories or written information about what how he actually felt about the incursion of non-Indian people into this area, and of course the Indians were always on the defensive after they got outnumbered and outgunned to defend their treaty rights and things like that. Do we know what some of his actual thoughts were? Obviously, he was trusted to represent some of the native interests in Washington, D.C., but is there much else that we know?
Well, yeah, of course, he never recorded anything himself, but the people that he ran into, there are a lot of early homesteaders up there, people like Orrin Patru, who had come in there in 1894 and was working for logging interests, and he got to know Busty well, and his son, in fact, Orrin had a homestead on the east side of Busty's Lake then, and his son, Dave, was there all the rest of his life. So they got to know a lot about Busty. Busty had a little fishing camp set up on Busty's Lake that's a quarter of a mile away from where his old home was. But he was just very much in the area there. But he was good to the settlers, and everyone liked him quite well. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he'd show up at unannounced times and expect to make himself at home. But people became accustomed to that kind of visits, and they liked him. There's another fellow who lives right in town here, Kevin Jones, who lives up on Highway 38. His father had a homestead between Wirt and Highway Number 6. And he said Busty used to come there. Of course, Kevin never saw him, but his dad used to tell about Busty coming, and very well received, fun to have him there, a good visitor, and they'd bring him some meat once in a while. And of course, he didn't mind stopping by for a little dinner with the homesteader either, which is fun, made for a good time all around.
Yeah. You know, we don't think of, and you mentioned that Busty was pretty much a solitary fellow there with, you know, he wasn't part of a larger Native community, I guess, in that region. And now, you know, the way things are today, northwestern Itasca County, there's a large Native American Anishinaabe communities around Inger and Wirt and the east end of Leech Lake. Was it unusual for a man like Busty of his stature to live alone amid more white people than Native people?
Well, I think it's the reason he lived there was he felt he owned the land. You know, the government had given him this land, and so he had a little feeling of ownership there. And apparently he had come from Canada. He didn't have any particularly strong ties with the local Indians, and there weren't that many local Indians there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the kind of land all along the Big Fork River in there. There was no wild rice or anything along the, once you got from Wirt down east, downriver, boy, the river had solid banks and there wasn't much cause to be camped along there.
Oh, I see.
However, there were people been camping there in that area for a long time because there was a fellow, Philip Hamilton, had a farm right next to Bussy's little place, and he'd plow that field and there'd be little pottery fragments from when the Sioux Indian had lived there, and so he just knew that the Dakota people had been in that area, left these broken pots with the little decorations on them, and Philip had also plowed up a big copper implement, which the state archaeological society had found by carbon-14 dating embers that were found in conjunction with these copper implements. Invariably, they were 4,000 to 7,000 years old, so you could infer from that somebody had been living there 4,000 to 7,000 years ago. They had left this big copper implement in the soil.
Mm. Yeah, a lot of us, I didn't realize for a long time that the Dakota were here and the Anishinaabe moved in from the east, and the Dakota then moved south and west, and they more toward the plains and prairies.
Right, and they did, they were rousted out about 1730, 1740, of course it wasn't all at one time. Mm-hmm. But we even have people, friends of ours from Inger, that traced their, they had one old grandpa up there, Ernest Howard, they called him Bun. Bun means Sioux in Chippewa language. And Bun was a descendant from a couple of little girls that had been left behind when the Chippewa came in and drove the people out of Red Lake up there.
Yeah, there was war, wasn't it?
Oh, it was a real war. And of course, the Chippewa had the rifles, and the poor old Sioux were still in the bow and arrow phase.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to run for their lives, and they left behind these two little girls of 5 or 6 years old. And they were kind of adopted by one of the Chippewa families there. But one of the men up there had, one of the Chippewa men just despised those Dakotas, and he vowed that he's going to eliminate these two little girls. And gee, one day he's paddling along the shore of Red Lake and caught them out playing in the sand there, and he jumped out of the canoe and whacked one, put her into the next world, and the other one took off for home. But her family protected her very much after that, and then she grew up and married a Chippewa person there, and the descendants came down, and her old Bun put Inger there, and he has many descendants right there in Inger today that have this.
Both heritage.
The heritage. So, and they really keep those stories very straight, and I think they're very believable because they have a history of keeping good records by telling it what had happened.
How did Cutfoot Sioux get its name? What does that mean? That area of northwestern Itasca County.
Well, that was at a time, of course, when these people were being driven out, and the Chippewa were pursuing the Sioux, and on Cutfoot Sioux Lake, there's a big long point, I think they call it Battle Point, sticks way out in the lake. But in order to avoid having to go all the way around this point to get out into the Mississippi River system, Winnebagoche, you could add a Onagam portage across there. And so the Sioux tore across this little portage. And the Chippewa were in pursuit, and they found that one of the guys had been shot. The Sioux had fallen in this portage there and had died, but they noticed that his feet had been frozen off or something terrible had happened. He was running around on these two clubs, and quite a disadvantage if you're on the lam, you know, trying to get out to Mississippi River. So here he had died in weeds, so they were kind of impressed with this, and they called it a Cutfoot Sioux.
Mm.
Because this old Cutfoot Sioux was lying there in the weeds right on Cutfoot Sioux Lake.
Yeah. Boy, Bill, you've had the opportunity, I hope you still do, to meet so many people and talk to them firsthand, either like the families of the descendants of the Dakota and the Anishinaabe. The people of the northern Itasca County, when you first moved up there,
mm-hmm.
how many people lived in Effie in 1949?
Well, there were over 200 people there, and of course, today.
So about as many, what's
there's
today?
There's about 91 up there now, it says on the sign, so things aren't, you know, if a person feels crowded in life, why, that's a good place to look over.
Yeah. Bill, thanks a lot for giving us a little slice of the history of Northern Itasca
County.
It's
a pleasure.
Yeah,
Scott,
I know it's a great hobby of yours.
Thanks,
Bill Marshall joining us this morning to reflect on the life of Busty Coggin, a legendary Native American leader from Northern Itasca County. Originally, as you said, from Canada, which, mm-hmm. of course, that Canadian-U.S. boundary meant nothing to the Anishinaabe as they moved and traded and harvested and lived on the land of the Northern Boundary Waters area. Bill Marshall joining us this morning on our local history segment.